5. We flew a Gulfstream to California and couldn't talk. The plane had been made available by a prominent music industry homosexual several weeks earlier, when our prospects seemed more plausible. The rental rate was giveaway cheap, the policy implications troubling. It was, however, a lovely thing, all walnut and leather and crystal. It didn't rattle down the runway as our usual crate did, but seemed to squirt, then lift effortlessly. I stared out the window. The wingtips were folded abruptly upward, like a paper airplane. Was there an aerodynamic purpose for that, or just whimsy? A rich man's toy? The opulence was nervous-making, inappropriate, especially that day. We were tanking in New Hampshire. We had a potential paternity suit in Mammoth Falls. There were 6 of us on the plane, matching pairs. The governor and Susan, Lucille and me, Uncle Charlie and Mama. Stanton had thought Mama would get a kick out of the Los Angeles star power. She would go on from there to Las Vegas for a day, then meet us in New Hampshire for the grand finale. The others were playing hearts while Susan Red and I moped. The governor was up and talky, slapping down cards, telling everybody what everybody else had, taking wild, meaningless risks and singing. He sang Red River Valley. He sang Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain. He had a determination, a fierceness to him now. The campaign was no longer about winning, but about personal survival. It was about the possibility of humiliation. He could not imagine such an outcome. It couldn't be true. His national career couldn't be over before it began, and this conviction gave him a giddy, febrile power. I was annoyed, frustrated. Too many cross-currents, too many confusing personal entanglements. I had just left William McAllister, somber and embarrassed. My mother and Arnie would be waiting for us when we landed at Santa Monica. I had been stunned by Willie's dignified befuddlement. He could not imagine his friend, the governor, betraying him in that way. He was confused. He'd wanted me to help him figure things out. He had not come to make a demand. His utter decency was unbearable, searing. The pain of it all, the promise of pain to come, was overpowering. It was real. Unslick, unspinnable. It was not cashmere. It couldn't be taken to Libby for dustbusting. It had to go directly to the governor. But we hadn't had an opportunity to talk. I tried to imagine how I'd tell him about this one. I tried to rehearse it. I couldn't. My mind was blank. Somewhere above the desert, Willie's sense of loss and bemusement propelled me into my own. Mother, waiting on the other end of the ark. Our relationship was affectionate, if placid. A mutual decision had been made, somewhere along the way, that we would let it go at that. She was a great believer in calm love. Even Father's departure had been oddly untempestuous. There were no scenes. He just left. He went to the American University in Beirut as a visiting something or other. He had never told Mother about the application. It must have been in the works for months. He never told her he was leaving, that their marriage was over. He just packed a bag and left. I was 10. They corresponded. "What does this mean?" she wrote him. "Whatever you want it to mean," he replied. Later, in a letter to me, it came out of the blue, unbidden, when I was in college, he wrote, "You may wonder what happened between your mother and me. It became untenable, through no fault of hers. I could not accept her unwillingness to see our differences. She did not care to acknowledge the issue there. In her mind, it was simply two people finding each other, and I needed to know why, or perhaps how. How could she make a leap so effortlessly, across territory normally so dangerous and melodramatic? How she could pretend that territory didn't even exist? Her placidity unnerved me. Her inability to see my color, a quality that at first seemed so fetching in her, so exhilarating and optimistic, ultimately became a statement I could not accept. That my color wasn't important. It seemed she didn't know me. It was unbearable." Mother's composure was unnerving. She mourned him. She hoped the phase would pass, that he would return. Then he went on from Beirut to Kuala Lumpur, and finally to Cairo. After 3 or 4 years, the process was seamless, unobtrusive, distressingly rational. She determined that it was not a phase. He was not coming back. And so, she moved on. I was sent away to school. She made herself available, but discreetly so. She did not inflict any trials or errors on me. Ultimately, though, there was Arnie, who was unexceptionable. He was Armenian, which I perceived as not quite white. To have gone all the way back to Missouri, or its equivalent, would have been an implicit recognition that her marriage to father had been a bridge too far. But Arnie was a step toward safety. At least, I had seen it that way. No doubt she hadn't. Her lapidary humanity was unassailable. Suddenly, riding that Gulfstream, I experienced a wave of anger and nausea, my father's confused, resentful blood pumping in my heart. We swirled down into Los Angeles, through filthy air. The governor and Susan were immediately snatched up by the music hotshot, who was small and neat, wearing a silver silk shirt, open at the neck, and jeans and running shoes. He got to Stanton first, before staff. Before we even left the plane, he bounded aboard. "Greetings, Fritz," he said to the pilot. "You didn't shake up the governor, did you?" Then he crouched next to Stanton and whispered, "Welcome to L.A., Governor. We'll put together a small group for you back at the house," he said. "Warren is there. Barry thinks he'll be able to come. Tim and Susan. Then we'll go on to the event." He followed the Stantons out of the plane, wrapping a consoling arm around Susan. His attentions weren't fawning or respectful, I realized. They were an act of charity. And so it didn't surprise me at all when John Conroy, our tall, amiable California coordinator, draped an arm over my shoulder as we walked to the terminal and said, "How are you?" I nodded. Then, "Henry, you are about to attend the most lavish secretary's night out in the history of Los Angeles. Everyone assumes we're dead. They think it's the better part of valor not to stare at the corpse, so they're giving their tickets to the steno pool. We are feeding the mailroom tonight. Should we tell the governor?" "No," I said. "What difference would it make? He'd sense it soon enough, if he hadn't already, from his benefactor's mortician act. I could predict his reaction, anger, at first. He'd be pissed at the big shots. But then, he'd look out at the audience and think, hey, all these other people are here. I can still sell them." Then a growing confidence and renewed sense of power when he did sell them. And, ultimately, a buoyant optimism. I ain't dead yet. I didn't want to deny him that process. It would be good preparation for New Hampshire. Lost in my mental staff work, I almost walked past Mother. "Henry," she said. She looked lovely, tanned. Arnie, who looked very L.A., double-breasted blue blazer and light gray slacks, dark blue shirt with a white collar open at the neck, gold chain at the neck, stood behind her, a hand on her shoulder, at the door of the General Aviation Terminal. I kissed her hair. She hugged me. Arnie patted me on the back. "Governor," I said, a bit too sharply. Susan turned abruptly, looking for bad news. Then, smiles. The governor and Susan doubled back. I saw him check out Mother. It was reflexive when he wasn't careful, if the woman was particularly good-looking. Then he overcompensated by giving Arnie a deep, meaningful handshake, a two-stager, two-handed, then an arm drape over Arnie's shoulder. "We're in the same boat, huh, Arnie?" he said, glancing at me. "Surrogate fathers to someone older than we are." Arnie laughed. "I used to feel, when we'd visit Henry in school and we'd all go out, that he was chaperoning," he said. "He's the best," Stanton said, "master of the universe." "Cut the crap," I said, too jovially, distracted by all my roles and responsibilities, by the soft west side breeze and the glare. How easy it would be just to stay in L.A. and be comfortable. And the jet fumes. We began to move through the small terminal, all plate glass, potted palms, and aviation sorts. The governor looked about, spotted the men's room, and I had a decision to make. I followed him in. It was a two-holer. I had to go, but didn't. I stood by the sink as he went. "Governor," I said. "They're great," he said. "Your folks, just great. I wish we could stay out here and... Governor." Now he got it. He looked at me hard. "What is it?" he asked. Fat Willie, the barbecue man, came by headquarters this morning, I said, reaching for calm but quavering a little. His daughter is pregnant. She says you're the father. He betrayed nothing. Who else knows? I shrugged. What does he want? Just to tell you, he was embarrassed, I think. The governor wheeled and slammed the wall open-handed on the tile. The sound was something between a slam and a splat. I just can't catch a break, can I? He said. He moved past me to the sink, leaned on it, stared in the mirror, ran water. I want you to call him. No, I better do it. I need him to understand that this is some kind of mistake, he said with an earnest intensity that was pretty convincing. I need to have some... How pregnant is she? Didn't say, I said. I don't think he knows. Can't be more than a few months, can it? 4 or 5 months, tops. And a girl? I didn't know what he was looking for. Yeah, he said. How could we know? But he'll give us a week, right? I suppose, I said. He was calm now, emotionless. I had never seen him so cold. There was something weird here. This stays with us, okay? Don't tell Daisy. So he knew about Daisy. It was amazing what was known and not known. Everyone knew everything except for the most basic things. Do you want Libby?
No.
He turned away from the mirror, leaned against the sink.
They all think I'm dead, he said. They're going to look at me and not look me straight in the eye. It's going to be sickening.
The worst will be the ones who tried to commiserate. The shit buckets who had troubles of their own, who got caught smoking crack or feeling up a teenager. The ones who got bombed and strafed by the press. They think I'm one of them now. Soon, Henry, someday, I predict, there will be a fraternal order of those who've been raped by the media. We'll have our own old age home, like the Will Rogers Institute, or whatever they do for bad actors out here. Ours will be the Mike Milken Home for the Fatally Flawed. He stopped, folded his arms over his chest, stared down. I was ready to move him along, but he wasn't ready to go.
A lot of them aren't going to show tonight. I don't care. I won't give them the satisfaction.
Henry? He stared at me very hard, his blue eyes roomy and rimmed with pink, but riveting.
Henry, you will never be ashamed that you did this. Do you understand? You will never have to swallow it or duck it or apologize for it. I'm not going to let that happen.
The door swung open. Conroy. Guys, he said. I went with Mother and Arnie for an early dinner at an airy place on Melrose, with brick walls, a high ceiling, and billowy fabric suspended in air. Sharp, breathtaking swatches of color. Royal blue, wine red, chartreuse. We would have this time, then go on, have dessert, and listen to the governor speak at the Beverly Hilton. It was almost a shock to be among normal people. People who didn't know everything. People who couldn't read your mind. It was annoying. That was, I realized, the other thing about Mother's composure. It was uncomprehending. She couldn't sense my confusion or utter discomfort, much less the aggravated impact the sultry ease of Los Angeles had on it. She was pleased to see me. She was proud of me. She was concerned the campaign wasn't going so well. He seems a wonderful man, she said.
And she's a looker, Henry added. I wonder what it is.
So, what are you going to do next, Henry? Go back to New Hampshire, I said, purposely avoiding Arnie's real question. What was I going to do after the campaign folded? I realized, suddenly, that Mother and Arnie were living through this embarrassment, too. But they were okay. They were living through it in an L.A. sort of way. It didn't matter that I was associated with a campaign that had become something of a national joke. It was a credential. It made me a marketable commodity. Arnie would be able to say, Henry used to work for Jack Stanton. And in Los Angeles, in the show business, they would know what that meant. I would be considered a veteran. A gladiator, someone who understands how bright the spotlight can be, who had worked at Media Riot Control, and that experience would make me valuable to other candidates for the Milken home. I realized that Arnie was about to offer me a job, and that it wouldn't be charity. "It's all right," I said. "It's a tough time. Look, under normal circumstances, we'd be dead. And yeah, I know it looks like we are, and we might be, but then you think, who's going to beat us? I just can't imagine any of those guys doing it. I mean, who can? You know what I mean?" I said, racing, sounding like Richard, sounding insane. "So we play it out. We go day by day. We got a week. A lot can happen in a week. Even if Harris beats us there, where else is he going to win? So I'm not... But you know, it's not an easy business." "Henry," Arnie said, "when it's over, your mother and I have been talking. When it's over, I can make a place for you. I mean, I could really use someone like you. It's nice out here, you know? You should enjoy life a little before you kill yourself working like this." "Thank you, Arnie," I said. "But at this point, I don't know that I'd be alive doing anything other than this. It's the strangest thing, like being a mine worker. New Hampshire is like working in a mine. You get this great tactile pleasure from chipping away at it. At least I did when we were working retail, coffee to coffee, winning the activists one at a time, before he became a household name. I sound nuts, right? Well, being here in Los Angeles is just so completely strange. It's like coming out of the mine, being blinded by the light. It's like almost painful being exposed to all this light." Mother was discomforted by my discomfort. She had no idea what I was getting at, and probably never would. So I did the next best thing. I tried to reassure her that it was only temporary. "There are people, Richard Jemmons, Arlen Sporkin, who do this over and over, who can't live without it," I said. "I'm not like that. I'm doing this once. I have made a commitment to Jack Stanton, and I'll see it through. But I don't think I have the stomach for this business, the desperation and intensity of it, if I didn't have a real rooting interest." "Well, if that's the case," Arnie said, laughing a little, "maybe we'll see you out here next Wednesday." "Yeah, it may not last much longer than that," I agreed. "But if it doesn't, I'll be real upset. He's got some problems, some weaknesses, that's for sure, but I think Jack Stanton's capable of doing some really great things for this country." His speech that night was awful, but not desperate. A plus. He stayed in control. He saw immediately what he was up against, a replacement audience and an unreachable one at that. The ballroom at the Beverly Hilton seemed distended and over-air-conditioned. The audience chilled and seated way at the other end of the hall from the podium. But that, I realized, was only my sense of room. These were people quietly, furiously engaged in one another, desperately checking out how the competition looked and dressed, performing intricate physiognomic calculations, whose cheekbones or breasts or fanny might lift them up from the mailroom or out from behind the reception desk, who had come up with the slightest hint of a new look, who had locked into the ephemeral Hollywood calculus of sensuality and sophistication. They were geniuses at such evaluations. It was their basic grammar. They did it the way Leon read a poll or Daisy cut a spot. And so, they paid Jack Stanton no attention at all, and he did something I'd rarely seen him do. He mailed it in. He didn't even try to distract them. It was an unlikely act of discipline, a conservation of energy, a sign of very intense seriousness on his part. Mother, of course, thought he was very inspiring. Arnie mumbled some encouragement, but clearly figured that Stanton had given up, that he was dead. I felt a reflexive twinge of elation. He was focused. He was ready to return to New Hampshire. I can sleep on a plane. Usually, though, the sleep is light enough that I'll sense it and wake when the engine's slow and the descent begins. That night, perhaps it was the Gulfstream, I was deeply, comfortably asleep when we hit the runway at Manchester. We seemed to land hard. I was up with a start, You could feel the cold even before we got off the plane. You could feel it through the plane. It was still dark, but there was a sense of impending grayness. Several people, bundled in goose down, determinedly waving our familiar red, white, and blue Staten for America signs, stood next to three vans. We had come all this way and gone nowhere. We were still in the same place. It was like chutes and ladders. We climbed ladders, we slid down chutes. We always arrived at the same airport, the same time of day, the same caravan waiting to take us to the same places, all of which we'd hit several times by now. The cold was painful after Los Angeles. We moved into it reluctantly. The governor looked at me, and this was the first time I'd ever seen him anything less than totally enthusiastic about entering the arena, and shrugged. Here we go again. Mitch was there to take suitcases, help Susan down the slippery stairway, and then, as we came off the plane, people emerged from the vans and began to applaud, a deep, solid, gloved affection. Staten walked down the line of them, hugging them, eyes tearing from the cold, or perhaps just tearing. The last was Danny Scanlon with a box of apple fritters.
"Brought you something, Governor," he said.
Staten looked around at us, glowing, with a goofy grin.
"God, it's good to see you, Danny. Why aren't you at work?"
"Took the week off. I'm working for you now."
"Well now, isn't that..." "Listen, everyone gather around."
And we did, in a tight huddle, arms entwined, warm on top, but with a bitter wind whipping our legs.
"I will never, ever forget you coming out like this for us," Staten said. "We have a tough week ahead. We may not win, but I can promise you this. No candidate will work harder these next 7 days than I'm going to, and you will never regret this, and I will never forget it. So, what do we do first? Mitch?
We've got the McGlaughy Wire Factory plant gate, but that isn't for another hour.
Come on, there must be something we can do before that," the governor said.
"A diner or a... Danny? Where's your competition this time of morning?"
"Silver Moon'll have some folks," Danny said. Silver Moon it was. Staten moved down the counter, then over to the booth, shaking hands. Truckers, factory guys with dark brows, lined faces, knit caps staring at him, shaking their heads, smiling private smiles.
"What you doing up so early, Governor?" one asked. "You starting the day or just ending it?"
"Last week, fellas," he said. "Working double shift. What can I do for you? What do you want to know?"
They looked at each other, thinking, "So what about Kashmir?" But no one had the guts, so one of them asked,
"So you going to take our guns?" "Only if you've got an Uzi or a bazooka."
He moved on and kept moving. He was up now. We all were. At one point, he jumped out of the van at a red light and began knocking on windows, waving, shaking the hands of fellow motorists. As we moved from plant gates to markets, I broke off and went back to the hotel where Arlen, Daisy, Lucille, Richard, and Leon were in the Staten suite. It was as if they'd never left, as if we'd always been there, arguing over the last week's media buy.
"Who's gonna watch the fucking thing?" Richard was asking. "They're just gonna be pissed off at us for preempting America's most fucked up home videos."
"You know what we get out of 30-second spots now?" Daisy said. She was sipping a Diet Coke. "Nothing. 30-second spots only reinforce the bad shit, that he's just another politician. You ain't gonna thrill him with bands and flags now. You're not gonna move him on healthcare. We gotta let them listen to him. Take him on, hit him with their best shot, you know? We gotta let them see that there's something there." She looked at Lucille. "Flannel shirts and axe tossing ain't gonna make it anymore."
"But if we go dark, they'll think we're folding," Arlen said.
Interesting. He and Daisy were taking conflicting positions. She was stepping out, away from him. The rift we had assumed, and subtly encouraged, was now open. She might have to find new work after the campaign. I hadn't had a chance to talk to her about any of this. I couldn't remember the last time we'd had a moment, a non-stressed phone conversation. Saturday night? Eons ago.
There's something to that, Daisy said, pulling back, acknowledging that Arlen did have a point. Maybe we can cut the buy, or cut the TV, or go to more radio. More bang, less bucks.
That's not nothing. You technocrats figure that one out, Richard said.
The question is the jackathon.
What do you think, Henri? Richard asked.
Seems to me we hit a weird fucking place when the advertising guru's going responsible on us. Old Daisy May here wants to take us down. No more spots. And blow it all on a telethon Saturday night.
Saturday night? I asked. Who's going to be watching TV on a Saturday night?
All the people who might not trust a candidate who fucks around, Daisy said. Leon, tell him about Kashmir.
She's got higher name recognition than Bart Nilsson, Leon said.
So?
What good does a 30-second spot do us at this point, she said. We've got to figure out a way not to be a typical politician.
How we doing, Leon? I asked.
Stable, he said.
Finally.
Harris is moving a little, up near undecided. We're half of that. I'm a little worried about Charlie Martin. They may be ready to give him a second look. Reason they haven't so far is there's been so much bad news about us, crowding him out.
Oh, here's another thing, Richard said. You want to hear the best fucking thing yet? Ozzy-O's back. At least, he's within 100 miles, giving a speech at Harvard tomorrow night. He says he isn't encouraging a write-in vote, but there's, get this, no way he can morally, stand between a voter and his or her conscience if she or he wants to write in his name or names.
Great, I said.
Forget Ozzy-O, Daisy said. Actually, it may not be bad. Say he takes 2 or 3%. We weren't getting that anyway, right, Leon? It just takes from Harris. Anything that takes from Harris, we are just in fucking love with.
Look, Lucille said. We gotta decide.
She was standing over the dining room table, holding a magic marker. 7 large pieces of poster paper in front of her. 7 days.
We've got a rally set for Concord Saturday night. Do we kill it or what? What are the logistics? Where's Lieberman?
Daisy called him at the Manchester headquarters.
Durham?
Yeah.
But we want real people, not just college kids. In fact, if we do this, I want someone independent. Get some fucking newspaper people.
Not the union leader, someone real, to pick the audience.
The other thing is, if we do Durham, can we still do Concord?
Push it back how much?
You think it's too late?
Okay.
We'll talk about it.
But we have until when for the buy?
Okay.
She looked around the room.
We can do it out of the public station at the university. We have until noon to decide. Someone want to call the governor?
He came in for an hour in the afternoon and napped. I saw him just after he awakened, bleary-eyed, feverish, coughing, eating, polishing off some of the dreadful reheated Campbell's minestrone the hotel peddled through room service.
Okay, Henry. We gotta call Willie, he said. You make sure no one comes in here while that's happening. Where's Susan?
Nashua, I said. Nursing homes.
Good.
He dialed it himself.
Willie?
Hey, man. Got your mojo working?
Yeah, well, it'll pick up when the weather turns. Look, I know this must be awful for you, just the worst. And I'm going to help you through this every way I can, just like always. But you gotta know, I didn't have anything to do with this. You understand?
He really sounded convincing.
God, Willie, you know, with all the talk around about, me, I'm sure she was thinking, well, you know how kids are, teenagers.
Yeah, I know.
You and Emily worked real hard to raise her right. I can't imagine what this would be like. But you have no, Willie. I'll be standing right by you in this. I will help every way I can.
She's getting care, right? Now that's important now. You don't want her thinking about doing anything crazy now. Now look, I've got to get through this next week up here. It's going to be a rough pull, all this stuff they're throwing at me. But I'll be back for a few hours next week, and we'll sit down and work this out. Be cool now. You have to give me this chance. You have to believe me. It's gonna work out. I know it seems dark right now, but you're still gonna get the chance to open up that branch in the nation's capital just like I said you would. I'd just die without your magic sauce. Without your friendship, Willie. I'll stand with you now. Anything you need, my man. He hung up and stared into space.
Danny Scanlon was waiting for us in the lobby with more apple fritters. The governor didn't wait for the van. He grabbed two right there. Not good. There was a lot of action in the lobby. Camera crews from Japan and somewhere in the north of Europe, Sweden maybe, were getting ready to move out. Campaign workers, scorps. Carl Allerad, an enormously successful mail-order businessman who was running a vanity campaign against the president in the Republican primary and had put something like $600,000 on the air, was trying to chat up scorps, who weren't buying. Over in the corner, Geraldo, who was taping a week's worth of shows in 2 days, sex and politics, stress and politics, media gurus, etc., etc., was giving instructions to his staff, which seemed to consist only of astonishingly good-looking women. He spotted Stanton and abruptly tried to plow through the crowd.
He's gonna want you as a guest, I said. The answer is no.
Governor, governor, he said.
Hey, buddy,
Stanton said, looking just incredibly pleased to see him.
What brings you up to the frozen north?
You! All America wants to know how you're getting through this. There's a lot of sympathy out there, Governor. Folks think you're getting a bum deal.
No kidding.
Stanton wasn't buying. He was eyeing the door, beginning to move. Geraldo moved with him. Look, you need to get your side of the story out. I can help you. We can do it any way you want. You set the ground rules.
Stanton stopped, stared at him.
Okay. Here are the ground rules. I'm the host, and I pick the audience. How about that?
Well, Geraldo said, what about me?
Take the day off, Stanton laughed. Go skiing. Look, I'm sorry. We've got a very tight schedule and a very tough race.
And we pushed on past him, toward the doors. Jerry Rosen was moving out the door just as we were, although I didn't recognize him at first, all bundled up with a knit cap pulled down over his eyebrows. He looked ridiculous, as if his mother had just dressed him for school.
Hey, Jer, you look like Nanook of the North, the governor said.
Cold out there, governor, he said. How you doing?
Plugging away. You coming to Portsmouth with us?
Nah. Going down to Boston to see Ozzio. He seemed almost apologetic.
Gotta stick with a local story, he shrugged.
Stanton put a conciliatory arm around his shoulders.
That's okay, Jerry. You gotta do what you gotta do.
So, what do you think?
Not good, he said. I hear the globe tracking has you down to the high teens. They say Martin's beginning to hot up.
It was old news, but interesting. We'd known the bottom had fallen out since Sunday. The scorps were just beginning to catch on. Rosen figured we were dead. I could see it in his body language. You could hear it in his voice.
Jerry, Stanton said, fixing him with the old, entirely compelling Stanton intensity. Listen to me. This is not over. It's not.
And he began to cough. We moved toward the van. Stanton ducked in, then looked back toward Rosen and smiled.
I'm going to surprise you, Jerry.
I hope so, Governor, Rosen said, opening up a little, then shutting down again abruptly, looking quickly around to see if any of his colleagues had caught his moment of weakness.
Asshole, Stanton said as we rolled off. I'm last week and he's looking for next week. If he thinks next week is going to be Ozzio, he's nuts. But it's interesting. None of them think next week is going to be Harris. That fucker is going to win this thing, and everyone's already discounting it. They are looking for another storyline. If we're close, if we do better than expected, we're their story.
You think so? I asked.
Who knows, he said.
Danny, where are those fritters?
Here, Governor, Danny offered them up front.
You know, you're getting too fat to be a corpse.
Fatten me up for the kill, Stanton said. At least I won't die hungry.
The funeral would be well attended. The crowd in Portsmouth that night was astonishing. They were jammed into a small, bare, cinderblock union hall. It was an obscure local of a dying craft, a 19th century vestige. The steamfitters, pipe welders, or iron benders, something like that. A fraternal organization for people left behind, shipyard folks. They were sallow, defiantly overweight, both men and women wearing union or tavern windbreakers, sock hats, the men with facial hair, some of the women in curlers and smoking long cigarettes. There was a table in the back with coffee, cookies, tuna sandwiches on small, soft dinner rolls. Another table with Stanton literature, which seemed as stale and discolored as the tuna. We were reaching the end of this thing. We came in through the rear, through a rush of noise. Terry O'Leary, an ancient gray man dressed entirely in polyester, burgundy jacket, yellowish shirt, stained striped gray tie, gray slacks, was playing jigs on the accordion, smiling wide through scattered teeth. He stopped when the governor came, played the first famous bars of Hail to the Chief, which would have seemed a cheesy sort of mockery if the old man hadn't assembled himself upright, in some distant shadow of martial dignity. Chin tilted up, shoulders square. The music silenced the hall. Jerry Delmonico, the local president, an aging Elvis, his pompadour gone gray and thinning in the back, welcomed the governor and said, "Now, Terry, how's about let's play the national anthem?" Which Terry did, and they all sang along and then recited the Pledge of Allegiance. I could see Jack Stanton was moved. This was the other end of the earth from the crowd in Los Angeles. It seemed, I thought, as if they hadn't been following the news the past few weeks, as if they had suddenly materialized from some pre-tabloid, pre-skeptical past. But that was wishful thinking on my part. Mickey Flanagan, the young but ancient in the Boston way, advance guy who'd worked this stop, found me off to the side of the hall, grimaced and shrugged. "What's the matter?" I asked. "This is good. You did great." "I did nothing," Mickey said. "He's a celebrity now. He's in the flesh. He's real. It makes all the other things in the flesh seem real, too. Space aliens, miracle diets. He's given credibility to all the world's garbage. He's a touchstone for the tabloid faith. You can light candles to him." I wondered if Stanton had picked that up. But of course he had, and it didn't matter. He would use whatever tools available. He was locked in now. "I want to thank you for coming out tonight," the governor began. "I know you work hard and don't have much time to relax. Some of us have more than we'd like," a younger, angrier sort interrupted. "Right, right. I understand that. In fact, let me see a show of hands, if you don't mind. How many of you have work now?" About half raised their hands. "How many of you are looking for work?" About a third. "Those of you who are working, let me ask you a question. As you look around the room at your brothers and neighbors and cousins who aren't as lucky as you, what do you see? You see people who wouldn't work if we gave them a chance? You see people who'd rather stay home and watch the soaps?"
"I'd rather stay home and watch the soaps," a big, blousy woman in curlers said, and they all laughed. "I'd rather do anything than punch in at Rizzuto's dry clean."
"I'll bet," Stanton said, laughing along with them. He was with them all the way now. "My mama worked jobs like that when I was coming up, and you know what? Before I was born, my mama was a sales clerk at Harry Truman's Haberdashery in Kansas City. That's how Democrat we Stantons are."
There was a pleasant buzz, an intimacy in the room. I'd never heard the Truman line before. The governor was reaching out for them.
"Well, after my daddy died and I was born, I remember seeing Mama come home from work, just bone weary, you know what I mean?"
Heads were nodding.
"I know she wanted to talk to me and play with me and ask me what I'd learned in school that day, but sometimes, you know how it is, you're just too tired to do anything but pop a dinner in the microwave, though we didn't have a microwave back then, of course, and blob out in front of the tube."
"You've got that one right," the blousy woman said. So I know it isn't easy for folks who do have work, either. The moms who have to work and have to worry about what their kids are doing after school. And I'll bet there are more than a few dads who lost these shipyard jobs and have to catch on doing whatever.
Doing shit, someone shouted.
Hey, you know what? Jack Stanton said abruptly. I'm going to do something really outrageous here. Hell, everybody thinks I bought the farm in this race anyway, so I got nothing to lose. I'm going to do something really outrageous. I'm going to tell you the truth. Cheers and laughter.
Yeah, I know what you're thinking. He must really be desperate to want to do that.
More laughter.
But okay. You've had to swallow enough garbage.
You can say shit, Governor, said the blousy woman.
We're X-rated.
Me too, if you believe what you read in the paper, he said, and the place exploded.
Now look. Let me get serious a little. Let me tell you something. Truth number one. There are two kinds of politicians in this world. Those who tell you what you want to hear, and those who never come around.
There were cheers and laughter.
The second kind, the ones who don't come around here, they're the ones who tell the uptown folks what they want to hear. Those boys don't deliver much either.
Except at tax time, the blousy woman said.
Fair enough. They do deliver then. But what's anyone done for you lately, right?
Applause. They were curious now. They wanted to know what was coming. So did I.
Well, I'm here now, and I'm looking at you, and you wouldn't believe me if I told you what you wanted to hear in any case, right?
Nods and applause.
So let me tell you this. No politician can bring these shipyard jobs back. Or make your union strong again. No politician can make it the way it used to be. Because we're living in a new world now, a world without borders, economically, that is. A guy can push a button in New York and move $1 billion to Tokyo before you blink an eye. We've got a world market now, and that's good for some. In the end, you've got to believe it's good for America. We come from everywhere in the world, so we're going to have a leg up selling to everywhere in the world. Makes sense, right? But muscle jobs are gonna go where muscle labor is cheap, and that's not here. So if all you want to compete and do better, you're gonna have to exercise a different set of muscles, the ones between your ears.
Uh-oh, said the woman. And Stanton did something really dangerous then. He didn't indulge her humor.
Oh is right, he said. And anyone who gets up here and says he can do it for you isn't leveling with you. So I'm not going to insult you by doing that. I'm going to tell you this. This whole country is going to have to go back to school. We're going to have to get smarter, learn new skills, and I will work overtime figuring out ways to help you get the skills you need. I'll make you this deal. I will work for you. I'll wake up every morning thinking about you. I'll fight and worry and sweat and bleed to get the money to make education a lifetime thing in this country. To give you the support you need to move on up. But you've got to do the heavy lifting your own selves. I can't do it for you, and I know it's not going to be easy.
He stopped, paused. There were no smart-ass remarks now.
You know, I've taken some hits in this campaign. It hasn't been easy for me or my family. It hasn't been fair. But it hasn't been anything compared to the hits a lot of you take every day. It takes a lot more courage to keep your family together, to keep on moving through a tough time where you don't know what's coming next, whether the paycheck's going to be there next week, who's going to pay the doctor bill, the mortgage, all the worries you have. So I've taken a few shots, but I can live with it. I'll get by. Hell, I'm lucky. I got my picture on the cover of a national newspaper. Maybe not the one I would have planned on.
There was some laughter. But this had become as intensely serious as I'd ever seen a political gathering.
And you know what? My picture there means that someone, maybe some group of people, thinks I'm worth taking a shot at. And you've got to ask yourselves, why? Why is Jack Stanton worth a ton of garbage they're dumping on his head? It may be because that's the way things are in this country now. If the garbage is there, or can be made to seem like it's there, you dump it. Or it may be that there are two kinds of politicians, the ones who tell you what you want to hear and the ones who don't bother telling you anything at all. And maybe some folks aren't very interested in there being a third kind.
So you should think about that when you cast that vote next Tuesday.
And silence. As if they were thinking too hard to applaud.
Henry, Daisy said, why do I always come to your room?
It's neater?
No, seriously.
Seriously? Hey, it's 3 in the morning.
No, turn over, she said. Look at me.
I looked at her. Her hair was tousled and over her eyes. The tortoiseshell barrette she'd used to pin it back were on the night table. She was cute. She was not beautiful. She was, more to the point, right there in my face. The allure of Daisy was also the difficulty. She caught everything. She let nothing pass.
I know you care, she said.
What to say?
Henry!
I brushed her hair back with my hand. I did it twice.
What I mean is, I would like to experience you in a non-campaign environment, she said.
You may get that chance soon enough, I said.
What I mean is exactly that. Next week. If we're in a non-campaign environment next week, I would like to experience you in that. Okay, Henry?
She looked at me. She went on.
I've got lots of miles. Miles and miles of miles. We could go to the Caribbean. I've got so many miles in American. We could take the space shuttle. We could lay on a beach. We could lay on a bed. We could really get laid. It'd be like paradise. We could have a wet bar in our room, room service, you know what I mean? She said.
We could lick our wounds. We could lick each other. We could drink rum drinks. You know, with little turquoise parachutes.
Parasols.
So you're on? She giggled.
Gotcha. Nailed ya.
I pulled her close, kissed her hair. What if we're not in a non-campaign environment, I said. What if we're still alive?
Well, she said, for us to actually be alive, I mean, alive, not just Jack and Susan being stubborn and ridiculous,
for us to actually be alive would take a run, and probably a Harris fuck-up, that would be so spectacular, such a rush, that it would be probably even better than non-campaign sex with you. So that would be okay, too.
How do you know how non-campaign sex with me would be?
Extrapolation. But Henry, surely, you rational, sensible, dark-hearted you, surely you don't think we'll be alive a week from now. I know it was 100 years ago, yesterday, but remember Newsweek? Newsweek had buried us with a derisive piece called The Anatomy of a Flameout. Someone inside, Sporkin was my guess, had given some classic distressed mood of the staff quotes. We were assumed toast. It was time for the consultants to start peeling off, cutting their losses, feeding the scorps obituary matter in order to fertilize the soil for their next campaigns. I was waiting and dreading the first sign that Richard had folded his hand. And here was Daisy, trying to act the classic professional, trying to distance herself, getting ready to go.
You see Nyan in the Globe today? She went on. A synthetic candidate meets his polyester epiphany?
Jeez.
The Boston Scorps all love Charlie Martin, I said. He's hip, he's funny, he's almost Irish. Only trouble is, actual human being folks don't get his act. They don't think running for president is performance art.
I went up on one elbow.
Daisy, you should have seen Jack tonight with the shipyard folks. Totally focused, disciplined, daring. Just a great fucking candidate. He was absolutely locked in. He bullseyed.
It's garbage time. No one's playing defense, she said.
When you ain't got nothing there, there ain't nothing to lose.
I don't know, I said. A week is a long time.
Not when you're dead, she sighed.
Daisy, do me a favor, I said, softer but harder. Don't do the hardened professional number, okay? Don't play hired gun. I still care about them, Jack and Susan, and I think you do too.
Not as much as you do, she said. And, shit, not as much as I do about you.
Look, Henry, okay, I'll admit it, I'm freaked. I'm pretty sure I fucked up my situation with Arlen these past couple of weeks. He seems cool enough, but he probably thinks, on some level, that I angled my way into the Stantons' hearts. No white boy from Mississippi, even a progressive one, likes to be upstaged by his junior partner. So I don't know what kind of future I have there. I also don't know what's going on with you. She didn't give me a chance to say anything, since she knew perfectly well that nothing I could say would meet her expectations. But she wanted the expectations out on the table, figuring that I was a decent enough guy not to slam dunk her gratuitously, and so she hurried on. I do suspect I got a commitment from you on the parasol drinks. I believe I tricked you into quasi-commitment by forcing you, Mr. Plubaffection, to correct me when I'd said parachute instead of parasol. I believe that if I'm clever enough to do that, I deserve a whirl. Daze, I said, feeling. I don't know, feeling something. You deserve more than a whirl, but you gotta believe we may not need to count frequent flyer miles for a couple more weeks, if for no other reason than to humor me. Okay, I believe. Sort of. An interesting thing happened the next day. People began to show up. Patsy McKinney, the blousy wiseacre from the Portsmouth shipyard meeting, was waiting for us in the lobby of the Hampton Inn at 6 a.m. So where do I sign up? Where do you want me to work? She asked. We sent her over to Brad Lieberman. By midday, 3 busloads had arrived after a long 2-day trip from Grace Junction. Elementary school classmates of the governor's, the high school principal, half the faculty, and Beauregard Bryant Hastings, the Stanton family doctor, a fabulous-looking fellow, thin almost to the point of consumption, and tilted somehow, sort of like the Tower of Pisa, wearing a cape and a hat and small round glasses like James Joyce, but with a long, wild mane of white hair. Johnny, he said to the governor. It sounded like Johnny, as if a cotton ball had lodged in his throat. Or perhaps it was just that his vocal cords had been sanded down by a lifetime of bourbon. We are going to educate these youngies about the intricacies of inspired governance, you hear? College classmates drifted in, Susan's law students from the state university, and people we'd met and connected with along the way, Ms. Baum, the lady who ran the library literacy program in Harlem, Russ Delson, the state treasurer of Tennessee, Minnie Houston, a community activist from Cleveland, dozens like that, ready to do anything, lick envelopes, go door to door. The Hampton Inn was full, as was every room in Manchester, so Lieberman bought out whole motels in cities and towns around the state and dispatched groups to Nashua, Portsmouth, Lebanon, Keene. He did this so smoothly, it was almost as if he had anticipated the throng. Our whole operation, so totally dispirited just days before, was running effortlessly in high gear. On Thursday, Bill Johnson, the Deputy Attorney General of Alabama, was in the lobby of the Hampton Inn, waiting for us as we came in from a lunchtime swing. Billy, what on earth? You up here for a ski vacation? President's Day weekend or something? Stanton asked. I figured you need another black face up here to sell those skinflint Yankees. Billy, shut up, Jack, Johnson said, hunking him. Just put me to work. Billy, I'm probably gonna get my ass kicked. That's why I'm here, Billy said. See, I don't believe that for a second. I figure you're gonna pull this out somehow, and I want to see it personally, for myself, and tell my grandkids. I want to see how you handle this. Case I ever find myself running statewide. You won't be in a hole this deep. Jack, don't go telling no nigger about the depth of holes in Alabama. Just put me to work. Henry, tell Brad to put the Attorney General here in charge of something. Something we can monitor. See if he's gotten any better at politicking over the years. And so it went. Each time we walked into or out of the palm and plastic lobby of the hotel, it seemed a slow-motion version of This Is Your Life, and it caused great huggy effusions from Jack Stanton. We were all, in fact, on the edge of tears, anger, exhaustion. But the candidate seemed to feed on it. He used the exhaustion and emotion to become a still more extravagant version of himself. He campaigned wonderfully,
he was running on sheer willpower now. He was not entirely sensate. And the ceremonies at the stump, meeting, greeting, talking, walking, were performed reflexively, relentlessly, but brilliantly. He could not make strategic decisions. He could not deal with staff. But he could lock in on any crowd, answer any question. He was getting sick again. His face was flushed and he was coughing, and he had to be aware of the pounding he was getting from the Scorps. It had reached the point of disgust. They didn't understand why he wouldn't just quit. Didn't he know he was history? Everyone had written it. An entire industry existed to analyze such things. A universe of Scorps, talking heads, pollsters, consultants, free-range wise men and gurus. And they had all taken up residence in Manchester now. They filled the lobbies and saloons, rented all the cars. There were crowds everywhere at all hours. It was instinctive, habitual, a quadrennial homing ritual. There was a liturgy. There were myths, patterns and ceremonial offerings. Jack Stanton had now been designated a ceremonial offering. It was a familiar role, reassuring to the tribe. He was George Romney, Ed Muskie, Gary Hart, the favorite who turns out to be Humpty Dumpty. His fall would be an occasion for portentous false humility among pundits, for ruminations on the hubris of conventional wisdom prematurely arrived at. He would become a cautionary tale, remembered in years to come and chuckled over. What was her name again? Cashmere MacLeod? There would be ritual pleasure in watching him fall. There would be analysis of the quality of the splatter. If only he'd just get on with it. The late-night saloon chat at the Wayfarer, Richard reported Friday morning, had drifted into the next phase, speculation about who might rejoin the campaign when Stanton dropped out. Ozzie O, Larkin, yes, there was talk about my old boss. I was amazed and disheartened to learn. Some other hero.
It's wounded pride, you know what I mean? Richard said. They told the world he's dead. They want him to fucking die already.
So what did you tell them, I asked. We were sitting in the bedroom of Brad Lieberman's suite, waiting to do debate strategy prep. In the outer room, Muffins were hustling the phones. It sounded like a real live campaign.
I tell them we stopped sinking. I tell them we're still in second. I tell them Lawrence Harris is a favorite son. We'll clean his clock down south.
Richard eyed me. Don't worry, Henri, I'm still on board. I'm even about one quarter believing the motherfucker will figure some way out of this box. In fact, put me down as believing that all this door-to-door retail shit he's been doing might be clicking on some half-conscious level. Shit, no one else is going anywhere. And I have never seen anybody work this hard. Yesterday, you should have seen him. He was standing in the mall in Nashua, mid-afternoon, just standing there, you know what I mean? Standing there, patient, answering the stupidest fucking questions from civilians that I have ever heard. Answering questions like, how can we get a stop sign over at the corner of Forest Lane? And, can you help me get my tax assessment lowered? Stoned, selfish, stupid people. And he's just patient as can be, explaining this and that, the answer man. Hey, we blow this, we can open a string of friendly government centers servicing mall rodent idiots. For a small fee, Governor Stanton will solve your problem.
Fuck you.
Yeah. You got that right. Fuck me, Richard said. Say one more thing, though. He is a horse. Got two busted ankles. Someone ought to put him down, but he's galloping down the stretch. You can only imagine what he'd been like running whole. He'd have been fucking secretariat. We'd been a-planning the convention by now. Instead, we're... Hey, Henri, what are we gonna do next Tuesday night?
What are we gonna do tonight?
We are going to gang rape Lawrence Harris.
A distinctive and surprisingly welcome voice boomed.
I am talking anal violation in extremis.
Oh, hi, Libby, Richard said. She stood in the doorway, darkening the sun. You got a weekend pass? This work release or something?
Scumbag, she said. You are lucky to be fucking alive, flashing your pathetic, wrinkled wiener at my darling Jenny.
If it'd been me, you'd be a member of the Vienna Boys Choir by now. What the fuck have you brought this campaign anyway? You're gonna save Jackie's ass with your brilliance this weekend? Oh, she said, spotting me and diving an octave.
Hello, Henry.
Hello, Big Bopper,
I said.
Excuse me, Henri, she crooned.
Elegance will not cut it. We're up against it now. We are in the shit.
Okay, Libby, I said. What would you do tonight?
Watch my ass, she said. Watch that mangy fucker Charlie Martin. Can't do much about Harris, but that mangy fucker wants a move up on us.
Not bad for a lunatic, Richard said. Speaking of which...
Lucille came in, followed by Howard Ferguson and Leon Birnbaum. Polster, Richard saluted. What you got for us?
Bupkis, Leon jiggled. No movement.
Bowel movement, Libby said. We gotta make it move.
Can't do that by just watching our ass, Richard said.
Wait a minute.
Olivia Holden. Am I discerning something here? Could it be hynemania? You walk in, wanting to gang rape Lawrence Harris. Your debate strategy is watch your ass. You're talking bowel movements. Is there some sort of message here? You got the grips? You stricken or what?
Jemmons, stow it, Lucille said. We got business. Where's Daisy?
Cutting radio spots, I said.
What?
Lucille asked.
What? You know what, Richard said. What we said, what we agreed on. The veteran guy on Vietnam, the surgeon from Laconia on health care. What about the greenie?
We said no to the greenie, Richard said.
We did not, Lucille insisted. This is a huge enviro state.
The fuck it is.
In the party it is.
And Lawrence Harris got every last fucking one of them with his natural forces bullshit.
Richard was up, shouting, taking it out on her.
Lucille, you are the stupidest. All right, we know that.
Libby intervened.
What we need to figure out is what we don't know.
We don't know how to win this thing, Richard said. You got any ideas, honey?
A muffin at the door.
Henry, you better come. I got the editor of the Nashua paper. Sounds serious.
It did sound serious, in a ridiculous sort of way. The Nashua paper had an exclusive. One of our spare drivers, a Lithuanian emigre who'd subbed for Mitch for a couple of days, was trying to make himself famous. He had heard Jack Stanton make racial and sexually charged statements, or so he said. He was intent on going public with this information now, the weekend before the primary, because the governor had promised to make the removal of Russian troops from Lithuania a major foreign policy theme, but he'd never delivered.
Get out of here, I said. You're kidding, right?
No, I've spoken to the man myself, the editor said.
Sounds to me like a disgruntled former employee, I said,
putting a finger in my out ear, trying to block the noise in the room, trying to concentrate.
Sometimes disgruntled former employees tell good stories, the editor said.
Oh, come on, I said. You're not really gonna go with this, are you? This is horse shit. Totally unprovable. Totally undisprovable.
What is it the governor supposedly said?
He called Luther Charles an ugly, mean-spirited nigger, and he allegedly called Harriet Everton a stupid woman with great tits. There were some other insulting tidbits, but those are the headlines.
It sounded half true, the Harriet Evergreen half. So I said,
that's all completely fucking outrageous. Don't you have any standards at all? I mean, did the driver provide you with any supporting evidence? Did he have a tape?
Well, no, but he does have a track record.
The driver?
No, your boss.
Give me a break, I said.
I had spent the past few weeks wondering what rock bottom would feel like. This seemed about right.
Let's say for a moment, just for the sake of argument, that everything you've heard about him is true.
It isn't, but so be it.
Let's say he was involved in a violent protest against the war 25 years ago, then used connections to skip out.
I began to hesitate because the argument I was intending to make suddenly sounded weak, defensive, stupid.
I was halfway along now and trapped. Oh, well. Let's say he had an affair. What is it about that track record that makes him a racist or someone who'd make sexist remarks about your leading environmental activist? Is it just that he's fair game now? Any accusation against him is presumed true?
Silence.
Maybe my argument wasn't so stupid after all. No, he was taking notes, letting me talk. This is just bullshit, and you know it, Mr. Bean. We don't know whether this alleged disgruntled former employee even worked for us. He certainly wasn't anyone central to the campaign. You haven't even told me his name.
Tiber Lazicus.
Who? But I did remember, vaguely. He drove for a few days in January when Mitch had the flu.
Tiber Lazicus. Lives in Derry. He's an engineering major at Merrimack.
Look, you're going to have to give us some time to check this out. Who knows if this guy is actually telling the truth? My reporter says he has confirmation that... You can't give us a day to check him out?
He gave a day, which took my day. I spent the rest of Friday on this, making calls, locating Tiber Lazicus, having him brought in. It wasn't something I had to do. I could have turned it over to Libby for dustbusting, but I guess, on some level, I couldn't bear to be a part of debate prep or any other aspect of the campaign. There was nothing to plan anymore. There would be no strategic breakthroughs. There was only the candidate, and he was moving on the moment, doing whatever felt right. He had stopped listening to us. So I spent the day on Tiber Lazicus, and I suppose a good part of it was that someone would have to deal preemptively with the Reverend Luther Charles, and I was best equipped for that particular task. Indeed, there was a morbid fascination to it. I had spent much of my childhood listening to the grown-ups talk about what a pain it was for them to deal with Luther, whom they called the Fallen Angel, the member of Reverend Harvey Burton's charmed circle who had fallen from grace. I left a message for him at the People's Empowerment Party, PEP, office in Washington. He called back late afternoon.
"My, my, my," he said. "Is this the Henry Burton? Henry the white man's Burton?
Sapman, my brother. Looking for work?"
"Not yet, Reverend," I said. "But I do need your help on something."
"You need my help on something?"
Luther Charles' first move, of course, would be to try to race me. He had done well for himself, playing King of the Negroes, but he knew that his reputation among those who had actually been there would never be what it was among those who'd come later. The old-timers maintained a discreet silence when asked about him, especially when asked by white journalists.
"If you need my help," he went on, "must be something awful big, awful big. I can't imagine that you would need my assistance with a community up there. Not many brothers up there in the White Mountains. Henry, whatever could it be?"
I told him.
"Ah," he said. "Foreign affairs, Lithuania."
He massaged every word.
"Henry, tell me, all them honkies gone plumb crazy, taking down your boy for pussy?"
He said pussy with the same resonant portent as the word community. He didn't have a great preachy voice. It was mid-level and sort of scratchy, but he did have all the preacher's tools.
"Imagine, them pale, scrawny, crazy fuckers ruling the world and us doing the laundry. It just don't figure. Why ain't they doing our laundry? It's science, Henry. They do technology, that's their voodoo. And that's about all they got. You need to invent something, call a European. If you need to lead or love or lift someone, phone a brother. Though I would guess Mr. Stanton is not deficient in the love department. Just like your grandpappy, Henry. In fact, just exactly like your grandpappy. I understand the governor likes his ladies melanin enriched."
That stopped me. He couldn't know about the McAllister girl. I had to say something, and fast, before he picked up on my hesitation.
"Better full strength," I said, "than melanin deprived. My daddy always said that you personally were the reason why blondes had more fun."
"Your daddy said that? He should talk.
Your sickly paleness is testimony to his proclivities.
You hear from him, Henry?
Sure, he writes.
Miss the son of a bitch. I could always identify with your pop, prodigal son and all, he said.
I have a weakness for prodigality, boy. If you want to consider it a return to the fold, there might be room in my rainbow for a staffer of your shade.
Imprisonment. For an instant, I wondered if the penalty for picking a disgraced contender would be slow time in interest group hell. I felt sick and terrified.
Reverend, let's talk about Lithuania.
He called me a mean-spirited nigger.
A disgruntled temporary driver with an axe to grind says the governor called you a mean-spirited nigger.
You work for a guy goes round calling people mean-spirited niggers? What's he call you?
Reverend, you think I'd work for someone like that?
A setup line. What an idiot I was.
Anything to pretend you ain't what you is.
Oh, Jesus, Luther, get over it. Are you going to make a fool of yourself yet again, blowing up this bullshit into a racial incident? There's no leverage for you here. We're losing. You could, just for once, do the right thing. Bank it. Then you'd have this tiny decency deposit to draw on next time you feel the need to be an asshole.
All right, Henry, he said, just like that. I won't bust your chops no more. But this is a debit in your own bank, a withdrawal from your Luther account. Cost you someday, plus interest.
Stanton came in about 5, steaming. I told him I'd taken care of Luther. He grunted.
Where's the shitbird? He asked.
In your suite. We walked down to the end of the hall. People said hello along the way, but the governor didn't respond. All the varnish was off now.
I can't fucking believe, in the midst of all this shit, I gotta massage this fucking creep. Who hired him anyway? Where'd he come from? I'm gonna kill Lieberman, fucking murder him.
We walked into the suite. Susan was there, talking quietly with Tiber Lysicus. He was pale and jittery, with light brown hair and a wispy mustache, a pathetic specimen. Jack, Susan said, sensing his mood immediately and knowing what to do. Tiber was just telling me about how the Russians took his father away. He was a bus driver. He had an accident, and they just took him away. Stanton shed his overcoat. I could see that he'd sweated through his shirt. His eyes softened.
And you never saw him again?
He asked.
No, governor, he said. They take him Siberia. And how old were you?
6 years.
Stanton moved toward him. There was a logistical problem. Lysicus and Susan were sitting on the couch facing each other. The governor wanted to get in as close as possible, touching range. But he couldn't usurp Susan's position, and he couldn't crouch next to Lysicus because there was a flimsy glass coffee table in the way. The coffee table would be hard to push aside. It was surrounded by comfortable chairs and a wall. He measured all this as he moved forward, making rapid, geo-emotional calculations. It was Jack Stanton's vision of hell, desperately needing to make a connection, but locked in a no-touch zone. He came in behind Lysicus and crouched down, propping himself on the arm of the sofa. The Lithuanian, now a Stanton sandwich, half turned toward the governor and away from Susan.
That must have been awful for you, Jack Stanton said. Just awful. And I can understand why you'd be so intent on wanting to raise the issue.
Russians are pigs, Lysicus said, reddening. Pigs!
Stanton, somehow, reached his right hand around the arm of the sofa and patted Lysicus on the shoulder.
I know, and I will do something about this. I just haven't had the chance. You know all hell has broken loose in this campaign.
Oh, yes. Kashmir. I hear about.
Susan rolled her eyes.
But I promise you, Tiber, Stanton continued. And this is a solemn promise, that your father will not be forgotten,
If the voters of New Hampshire will allow me to continue this race, and if, in their wisdom, the American people elect me president, I will liberate Lithuania.
But you no mention now?
I will mention now. Tonight, I promise. But if I do, you will tell the newspaper editor that you were mistaken, that you were angry and were acting out of pique?
Out of... what? Pig?
You were very angry.
Oh, yes, very angry.
He had Tiber up now, and was shepherding him toward the door, a hand on his arm, soothing him.
I know what it's like to lose a father, Tiber, but not the way you did. I can't imagine your loss, your sense of rage. You must understand it's difficult for Americans. We've been so lucky. We have so much to learn from you. I really appreciate your coming. I really appreciate your bringing this to my Henry, see that Mr. Lazikas gets home okay. Bye.
He slammed the door. The last debate of the New Hampshire primary was held at a Catholic girls' school. It would be an auditorium debate with a live audience. Good for us. Stanton always worked better to people than to cameras. There were green rooms for this one, but no one used them. The candidates gravitated toward the brightly lit cinder block hallway. This would be their last group appearance. They knew one another now, were fascinated and disgusted by each other. They would look back on this as a period of intensity and absurdity, sort of like a brief, disastrous marriage. There would be a bond. They would always have New Hampshire.
Hey, Jack, Bart Nielsen said. Guess this is it.
Stanton nodded. Charlie Martin came over wearing a tie with little hot air balloons on it.
Kind of getting used to these folks up here.
They're just great, Stanton agreed. Even after all the shit, they've been just great. They really listened. They really cared about the issues. I was just out in L.A., and it was like a different country. They aren't having this election out there.
And now, a first. Lawrence Harris approached, looking prohibitively academic. He was wearing a brown herringbone jacket, a Tattersall shirt, and forest green knit tie. His reading glasses dangled from a lanyard around his neck.
Well, mates, he said, our last tango.
I could see Stanton's jaw tighten. Harris actually reached up and patted him on the back.
I just wanted to tell you fellas what a memorable experience it's been for me.
Yeah, Charlie Martin said. It's like we're lost in the Andes or something. The plane went down in this strange tribal culture where the only thing they care about is politics.
Then again, Stanton said, checking out Martin carefully, maybe we're the Donner Party.
Well, Harris said, breaking off, his work here done. I just hope we'll all be able to unite when this is over. I think it will be very important to have a united party if we're going to win in the fall and set about the difficult work of getting the fiscal situation under control.
Larry, I'm sure whichever one of us wins the nomination will be honored to have your support, said Bart Nielsen, with a deftness I'd not anticipated. Harris sniffed, grinned uneasily, retreated. Stanton and Nielsen walked together down the cinderblock hall.
Bart, Stanton said, his arm resting gently on the older man's shoulder, whichever way this comes out, when it's over, I'm with you. We work as a team, far as I'm concerned.
Nielsen stopped, looked at Stanton.
Jack, he said, I've been a loyal Democrat all my life, always voted the party line, but if that bloodless prick wins the nomination, I'll stay home in November.
This is a great country, Bart, Jack Stanton said with a smile. And, lest I miss my guess, if that boy is going to win the nomination of this party, he's going to have to learn a few things about the folks.
Pay good money to see him get that education, Nielsen said.
May be able to see it for free, Stanton said.
The candidates stood at walnut podiums in front of a deep, rich burgundy velvet curtain. It was nicer than the usual banal TV station blue. That, plus the audience, plus the climactic nature of the event, added a depth and resonance to the proceedings, All four of the candidates seemed larger than usual, almost presidential. Especially Jack Stanton, who was on a mission that night. He took care of Tiber Lazicus in the first 10 minutes. The opening question was, what are the three main challenges facing the next president? The economy, of course, crime certainly, but instead of healthcare, which normally would have come next, he drifted into America's place in the world. We must provide leadership. The Cold War may be over, but challenges remain. We must encourage Russia to continue its path to partnership in the Western Alliance, and we must make sure that the Russians know that partnership will not be complete until they take the final steps to disengage from their former republics, especially the Baltic republics. We must be sure that Russian troops are no longer stationed in Latvia, in Estonia, in Lithuania. And of course, there's other pressing business to take care of back home, healthcare. Hey, Jack, Charlie Martin interrupted. You gonna hog the whole show? Titters from the audience. Jack? Jack, focus, Susan whispered. We were sitting in a green room just off stage, the two of us and Danny Scanlon. Take it bit by bit, Susan said. You can't do it all in one bite. He seemed to hear her. He pulled back. He let Charlie Martin get lost in healthcare, and Bart Nielsen do his New Deal Redux number for a sad last time. Bart was aiming it at Larry Harris, digging it at him, talking about the need for compassionate government, a government that would meet the needs of the people. Harris was shifting impatiently, one podium to his left. He was pursing his lips. The smart move was to let the old guy have his valedictory. Senator, if I may, Harris interrupted. Susan grabbed my arm. Good, she said. Senator, Lawrence Harris intoned, head tilted back, eyes almost closed. We would all like to do many things. I, for example, would have loved to play shortstop for the Red Sox, but that was not a realistic wish on my part. I'm left-handed. You can't have a left-handed shortstop. The joke fell flat. Harris didn't seem to notice. He would teach us now, tell us about reality. The reality is, we can't afford to be as compassionate as we'd like. The reality is, we've been spending far too much for far too long. The reality is, if we're going to leave a better world for our grandchildren, the American people are going to have to live with some pain. Sacrifices will have to be made. Larry, you gotta be kidding, said a familiar voice. Excuse me, Governor Stanton? I mean, I know you're from up here and you're more popular than a Christmas turkey and all, but I've got to wonder just what state you've been living in. I mean, the state I've been traveling in. We've all been practically living here these past few months. You go anywhere in this state and you see folks who've had a great deal of personal experience, recent personal experience with pain. I don't know if the world's reached you up there at Dartmouth yet, but we've got a recession going on here in New Hampshire. Folks are hurting. They're losing their job, losing their homes. Senator, are those the folks you're saying gotta learn to sacrifice? Just what else you want them to give up? Governor? No, Larry, you just let me finish. Then you can go on with Economics 101. Laughter. The crowd, Harris's crowd, was with us now. I don't mean to make light of what you're saying. We all know you got a point. Republicans been running deficits like a bunch of drunken sailors for a decade. We gotta do something about that for sure. But we gotta fix this economy first. You keep on talking about our grandchildren, and we're all concerned about that, but what about the parents of our grandchildren? We just gonna cut them loose, let them drift? Larry, tell us about your plans for them. No applause, but a buzzing. I think they're looking for a leader, Harris said, looking directly at Stanton. I think they're looking for someone who is decent, honorable, someone they can trust. A scattering of applause, but also a few hisses. Cheap, Susan said, but not ineffective. I gave our boy the decision on points. But who could say? Susan was making the same calculations. We won the hall and the TV audience, she whispered, but Harris probably took the bite.
Right. Stanton's case against Harris, succinct and deadly as it seemed in real life, was too long, too complicated to communicate in a 2-minute spot on the evening news, especially in the standard Sparks flew among the candidates debate rap that broadcast scorps inevitably favored. In fact, Stanton might even come off looking petulant, petty. They'd go with the governor's economics 101 bite, and with Harris's decent, honorable riff. Harris would come off stable, straight, while reinforcing our decency problem.
Shitty prep, Susan said.
You think he would have let us prep him? I said, defensively.
Any punch, Danny stammered.
Shush, Susan said, flashing a stern look at him. Danny recoiled, as if he'd been shot, and Susan quickly relented, ashamed.
Danny, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Any punch he threw would have been countered, Danny said, seeming to assume Susan Stanton would have the same weakness for late-night sports blab as the governor.
He wins it on my scorecard because he threw a punch for the people. Can't play rope-a-dope now.
Susan inhaled sharply and hugged Danny, burying her head in his neck.
No, you're right, Danny, she said, pulling back, putting her hand full, flat on his cheek. You're right, honey. We can't play rope-a-dope now.
Meanwhile, on stage, the storm subsided. Everyone said what he always said. The closing statements went about as expected, until Charlie Martin, who was last. Our party has a grand tradition, he said with a stentorian seriousness that did not quite make it. A tradition of energy, compassion, and honor. We need a candidate, a standard bearer who is energetic, compassionate, and honorable. I ask you, my fellow Americans, to make the following judgment. Which among us has the energy, the compassion, and the honor to serve and to lead?
I could see where this was headed, so could Susan.
Uh-oh, she said. Senator Nielsen is a distinguished Democrat. I am proud to call him a friend. Martin paused, and for an instant I hoped he wouldn't pull the trigger. No such luck. He's had a long and distinguished career, but does he have the energy to take this battle to the Republicans? As for Senator Harris, I know he's a neighbor of yours. He and I served together in the Senate. I know the quality of his mind, and as president, I would want him very close by. I would depend on his advice. But his is an academic intelligence. It needs to be leavened by practicality. And Jack Stanton, he paused again, and again I had a twinge of hope. He'd only implied Harris's lack of compassion. There was a chance he'd be equally cautious with us. He wouldn't want to get too graphic, and he didn't, which made it all the more brutal. Now, Governor Stanton, we all know, is energetic and compassionate and intelligent. And he has been the victim of some questionable charges in this campaign, very questionable charges. But even if you believe that he has been unjustly slandered, even if you believe he is an honorable man, we must, as Democrats, make a practical judgment. Is he damaged goods?
I think I gasped. It was so stark.
Would he be able to make the best possible case against the Republicans? Or would he be too busy defending himself against an incumbent and a party that hasn't been shy about using any and all available weapons in the past?
Sucker punch, Danny said.
Susan shook her head, shrugged, and began to wander out into the hallway to greet Jack when he came off. As it happened, Charlie Martin was off first. Jack Stanton was lingering, as always, reaching down into the audience to shake hands. And Susan grabbed the senator by the arm, smiling sweetly.
Hi, Charlie, she said.
He stopped, gave her a peck on the cheek.
So that's how you got all those medals in Vietnam, she said. What do you get for bayoneting someone in the back? A double cross with oak leaf cluster?
Susan, it's part of the game.
Charlie, it's not a fucking game. Stanton came last. He pushed Susan back into our green room and closed the door. He slammed his fist on the top of a chair.
I just can't get a clean shot, he said.
You did good, Governor, Danny said. You told him.
Yeah, but I took some too.
He turned to Susan.
Was it worth the risk?
What have you got to lose? She replied, coolly. But then, sensing his distress, added, You couldn't have said it any better than you did. Someone had to. I'm glad it was you.
My turn.
Martin was coming at you, no matter what. It's probably a good thing you took a poke at Harris. Shows you can still do some damage. The Scorps may have some second thoughts about your viability.
If I only believed that.
I was exhausted, totally wiped that Saturday. It was a beautiful day, a sudden thaw. There was a Carolina breeze. Everything was dripping, melting. But Charlie Martin had taken it out of me. His argument sounded too plausible for comfort.
Oh, for Christ's sakes, Henri! Are you too fucking literal?
Richard said as we speed-walked. There was no other way with Richard. From the hotel down to our campaign headquarters on Main Street. It was a good mile or so, but there was the sense now that our work was pretty much done. There was nothing more to do. We were killing time. We walked past a scruffy row of fender and lube shops.
No one gives a shit about closing statements, Henri, Richard said. By the time that stupid fucking hippie kamikaze unloaded, only God was watching the show. Folks at home were channel surfing. Half the folks in the hall were rassing around, looking for their scars and gloshes, you know what I mean? Anyways, you tell me you never heard that argument before? Damaged goods is so old, even the small city Scorps ain't writing it anymore.
It's one thing for the Scorps to write it, and another for Charlie Martin to present the whole world with the biggest, fattest soundbite imaginable, I said. You know, Richard, you know what I mean?
What is this?
Richard asked. We were near downtown now, moving through clusters of volunteers. Some were standing with signs on street corners. Others were working sidewalk tables.
You think only ugly girls interested in politics nowadays? Richard said. This is like the inverse Miss America contest. You gotta figure the Republicans do better than this, right? They got cheerleaders and prom queens. We get tree huggers and now ninnies. We get whole armies of women who look like Lucille.
Richard did have fairly mainstream taste, and a fairly constant frustration level.
Richard, shut the fuck up and look at this, I said.
It was, in fact, a remarkable scene. Downtown Manchester was a political street fair. There were clowns and mimes. The Rotary Club was giving away hot dogs. The millionaire vanity candidate was handing out purple balloons with his name on them. There was a Lyndon LaRouche sound truck circling, playing Beethoven's Ninth. There were Operation Rescue fanatics waving dead fetus posters. Harris volunteers were handing out green and white pom-poms. A Nielsen Dixieland band played in the park facing the Holiday Inn.
Brigadoon, I said.
By midweek, it'll all be over. Just some techies packing up. By next weekend, half these storefronts will be empty again.
I mean, Richard said, oblivious. Henri, you assessing this talent? Pathetic. Hello, Tom.
Tom Brokaw was coming the other way, with Richard Cohen, the Washington Post columnist, and several other Scorps.
Hey, Jemmings, you got numbers? Brokaw asked.
Steady as she goes, Richard said. You?
Here the Globe Track has you up nudging 20 again.
And Harris?
35 or so.
That boy's only getting 1 out of 3 in his home state. With half a ton of trash in our head, wait till we get him down home.
You gonna make it home? Cohen asked.
Well, who the fuck else gonna make it?
Richard snapped.
Ozio?
In the South? In the South? Richard shrieked. You talk about Orlando down home, they think you're talking about Disney World. You got any other hot ideas?
Cohen shrugged and smiled, palms up. We moved on.
Jeez, Richard said. Heavy fucking lifting. It's like going through life carrying Libby Holden on your back, and they think we don't earn our money.
The Globe number. Leon's showing more than that, I said.
Leon was, in fact, showing us moving again after the debate.
A bump. A bump lit. A statistical hiccup. We're still fucked, Henri.
What do we need? I asked as we passed Martin headquarters, which was overflowing with student volunteers. Several dozen college kids were milling on the sidewalk around a very attractive blonde who had a street map and a megaphone. She was giving out assignments. Richard gawked at the blonde. She smiled back at him.
Listen, honey, you want to learn about the intricacies of politics? He asked.
She shook her head slowly, sexily, and blew Richard a kiss.
What do we need? I asked again. I'm smitten, he said. Fucking hippie has the best looking talent. Wouldn't you know it? I'd take that girl door to door in a hot flash. We'd push every doorbell in town.
Richard, for Christ's sake! We were stopped at a red light. A Harris station wagon sped past, slushing us pretty bad.
Fuck you, asshole!
Richard shouted. Then, to me, he said, we need one out of four. Long as natural forces stays under 40 and no one comes up behind us, we can limp our sorry asses out of here with 25, and we're nowhere near that. Leon has us 21 on a 3-day track, I said, saying an argument I didn't quite believe, which means last night and this morning had to be near 25.
Ain't sample size, Richard said. You call four people. One of them giggles like a heathen and says, well, that redneck son of a bitch sure trucked it to the old Professor Perfect last night. Maybe I'm for him.
You think that means something? Call my broker. He'll say you all sorts of shit. Our headquarters, halfway down the next block, wasn't nearly as bad as I'd feared. It was alive, every bit as alive as Martin's had been, and a better sort of crowd. Student vols in plaid flannel and jeans mixed with older folks in union and tavern windbreakers. Cross between a Nirvana concert and Tuesday Night Bowling League, Richard said.
Not bad, not fucking bad at all, for a cripple.
Brad Lieberman sat at a desk in the front, working a phone, handing out piles of literature and Xerox neighborhood maps to a line of coordinators. He waved to us, gave a thumbs up. We squeezed past the pegboard partitions behind Brad to the larger back room, which had three long rows of tables with telephones and 30 people working them. Off to the side was another table with two large coffee urns and dozens of boxes of donuts, cascading, half open, half eaten. Interesting people were working the phones. Bill Johnson was back there, as was several of the gang of five, and Mama, puffing slims and radiating cheap perfume from the middle of the row, her raven beehives sticking up like a textile factory bobbin, all of them working down lists of people who'd been called at least once in the past month. I went over to Johnson when he put down the receiver. How's it going?
Twos and threes, he shrugged. We ain't lighted up.
No fours?
Shitload of fours. But you gotta expect that. Kind of every hang-up before.
Where's the candidate?
At the mall, I said.
He's just gonna stand there and work the mall all day, if you can believe it.
No touring?
He said every minute in the van is a minute wasted. He figures he'll get a steady flow all day this way.
He's a fucking horse, Johnson said. Always was.
Richard came over.
Henri, you ain't lived till you heard Mama work a phone. This is Mary Pat Stanton, the candidate's mama. Now, are you gonna vote for my boy or not?
Hot shit.
Richard, I said, getting sort of excited now. Let's get Ken Spiegelman off the phone and see if he can give us something for the candidate to say on the telethon tonight about healthcare. Spiegelman was a Gang of Five member from the University of Chicago. He was young, slick, accessible. Too young for Treasury Secretary, but building his portfolio.
Why, that's just brilliant, Henri, Richard said, diving into the middle of Mama's row and retrieving her. We say the exact right 25 words about healthcare tonight, and we'll just walk away with this thing, right?
I got a better idea. He wrapped an arm around Mama, cupped his hands.
Hey, everybody, listen up. Best looking woman in the room got something to say.
Go ahead now, Mama. Go on, stand up on this here chair. Mama didn't need much prodding.
She was wearing a flagrant orange and white State U tracksuit.
Y'all having fun?
She croaked and smiled, her big, broad lipstick and mascara face bursting into utter glee.
Well, listen. I know you're working hard for my Jackie, and he's the best a mama could have, and y'all's the best friends our family could have, and I ain't got no highfalutin' talk like Mr. Senator Lawrence Harris.
There were hoots and whistles.
But in my book, y'all are just exceptional. With a gang like this, we could just do serious damage in a roadhouse. Get me, Jimmins? We could just rip up a joint.
Mama, I was 30 years older, I'd be licking your ear, Richard said, playing to the crowd, which roared.
And I'd be squealing like a pig,
Mama said, doubling over, hands on her knees. I had to admit, I'd never fully appreciated Mama until that moment. I considered her something of an embarrassment, a joke. But she had everyone in that room up now, and feeling good. Every face was beaming. She was her son's mother.
Now, listen up, y'all. I'm a-gonna sit down now before I fall down. But I love you, and I'll never forget you. Win or lose, come rain or shine. Ain't this just grand?
She started down to whoops and applause, then up again.
Now, just a second. I'm listening to what I just said, and I would like to amend it a little. Okay, Jimmins?
You have it, Mama, he said.
The lose part, she said. I didn't mean to say that, win or lose. My boy ain't gonna lose. You folks ain't gonna lose. I don't see a loser in this here room. And I've seen more than a few losers in my sorry old life.
The place was rocking, hoots and whistles.
But my Jackie ain't no loser, and y'all's his friends, and you ain't losers neither. So listen up. We are going to win this thing. We're going to steal this thing right out from under Mr. Senator Lawrence Harris's nose. Then we're going to go down home and whip his sorry butt. And that's all I'm going to say.